We have a glut of ethane from drilling for natural gas, and it's being shipped overseas.
If we weren't exporting ethane right now, they'd be giving it away for free.
I'm Reed Frazier. This week on the Allegheny Front, I head to Scotland to see how some of the ethane from Pennsylvania's fracking boom is fueling the world's thirst for plastic. Then something's killing apple trees in Pennsylvania.
You can just see the first two trees you hit right here have shut down just over the past few weeks.
We ask a researcher why this is happening. And we hold our noses as we take you to kitchens where people are recycling oyster shells for the Chesapeake Bay.
There's flies everywhere and it's nasty. But we're doing something good. Let's get out of here.
Don't you get out of here. Stay with us for those and more environmental stories on the Allegheny Front. Welcome to the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier, sitting in for Kara Holsapple. Governor Tom Wolf announced he's moving Pennsylvania toward implementing its first tax on carbon emissions. He signed an executive order directing the Department of Environmental Protection to begin the rulemaking process that would allow Pennsylvania to join other northeastern states in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. This would force electric utilities to pay a fee on the carbon dioxide they produce. Making the announcement on Thursday in Harrisburg, he said climate change is already hurting Pennsylvania, and the time to act is now.
If we want a Pennsylvania that is habitable for our children and for our grandchildren, where temperatures aren't in the 90s as they were yesterday in October, and flooding doesn't destroy homes and businesses over and over again, we need to get serious right now about addressing the climate crisis.
The plan could face pushback from Republicans and some Democrats from coal and gas-heavy parts of the state. A similar action by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam was blocked by his state legislature earlier this year. Speaking of severe events linked to climate change, a Pittsburgh-based robotics researcher is creating an early warning system for landslides. For State Impact Pennsylvania, 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports this technology could be especially useful in Allegheny County, which experienced an unusually high number of landslides last year.
The landslides were due to a wetter-than-usual winter, and that was likely related to climate change. Experts say Western Pennsylvania can anticipate more landslides in its future. Carnegie Mellon University's Christoph Mertz wants to be able to predict where and when these earth movements will take place, so he's programming computers to analyze images of hillsides in order to spot the beginnings of landslides.
Like it can see dirt or if there's an accumulation of stones or something like that. So you can train an algorithm to see these things and to notify somebody.
Mertz says this project could be completed in about 5 years. For State Impact Pennsylvania, I'm Sarah Bowden.
And we should say Sarah Bowden is on staff at WESA, which receives funding from Carnegie Mellon. Well, apple lovers, it's that time of year again. Time for apple picking, baking apple pies, and eating apple butter, if that's more your jam. Pennsylvania is the nation's fourth largest apple producer, but there's a new threat to the U.S.'s annual $4 billion apple industry. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that researchers are calling it rapid apple decline and are trying to figure out what's causing it.
Noah Petronic is worried about his apple trees. He's orchard manager at Sorgel Orchards in Wexford, just off the highway north of Pittsburgh. We start walking down a row of Braeburns. Most of the trees look healthy, with green leaves and bountiful pink fruit. But a couple have taken on a strange rusty hue and are clearly struggling.
You can just see the first two trees you hit right here have shut down just over the past few weeks. We can walk through it here and I can point out about another five or six that are shutting down.
Petronic says he started noticing this around 2013.
You have beautiful crop on, you know, especially August, September, your apples are starting putting on color, size, especially your later varieties like Fuji and Braeburn and Johnnigold. And then all of a sudden you come back a week later and it would be dead.
Apple trees are actually made up of two parts that are grafted together. Growers choose a type of rootstock based on the soil or size of the trees they want, and then graft the apple varieties, the Braeburn or Golden Delicious, onto it. Petronik scrapes his boot along the bark of a dying tree just above the root.
You can see where the graft union is down there. That's just totally necrotic. It's rotting away. Looks like
they're using necrotic.
Necrotic. If we would peel it away, actually, you could actually see the rot.
That rot at the graft is the telltale sign of rapid apple decline.
This year, it's been horrible.
Carrie Peters is an associate research professor at Penn State's Fruit Research and Extension Center in Adams County. 70% of the state's apples are grown there. Peters has heard from around 50 Pennsylvania apple growers this year.
I've been so overwhelmed in 2019 by reports of massive tree die-off that it's been difficult to keep up.
Peters has been trying to get to the bottom of it. She and other researchers have looked at common apple problems like soil pathogens, viruses, and even rodents.
And everything came back negative. But the common thread with these declining or dead trees is that the collapse was at the graft union. The roots were perfectly healthy, and the graft union was dying.
What researchers think they've learned so far, this is not an insect or a disease that spreads from tree to tree. A study by Cornell University published this year found that weather-related stress like drought and severe cold could be an underlying cause. But Peters doesn't think that's the whole story. She has other theories, including increased rainfall or certain herbicides. She says a variety of stressors could be working together to lead to rapid apple decline.
We just don't know.
Back at Sorgel Orchards, Noah Petronik shows me a new variety he just planted, Crimson Crisp, and then some 40-year-old stamen winesap trees. He takes a bite of the vintage variety.
It's just baffling. It's heartbreaking, really, because you're taking care of these trees, you know, for years and years, and all the care that you can give the tree, you know, and all of a sudden it just, you know, doesn't make it.
Petronik says farming isn't getting any easier, but to continue growing local produce for customers, orchards like his will have to learn to adapt to rapid apple decline. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Half of the land area of Pennsylvania drains into the Chesapeake Bay, and that includes a lot of pollution, mostly from agricultural runoff and sewage overflows. Recently, the state's come under fire from Maryland's governor for not investing enough money to help clean up the bay. A handful of Pittsburgh restaurants have joined a recycling effort to improve water quality in the bay using oyster shells. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple has the story.
Jessica Lewis says shucking an oyster is like picking a lock.
You press down and then you just wiggle, pop it open. The abductor muscle right there, you clean that.
Lewis is the executive chef of Spirits and Tails at the Oaklander Hotel in Pittsburgh. She runs a small knife around the sides of a closed oyster shell.
You can't really muscle through it. You clean under it and see all that liquor? This one's got a lot of liquor in it.
That's the salty ocean water still inside the shell, and it makes the oyster slide out smoothly into your mouth.
That's perfect. I'm gonna take this one right here.
Lewis says they go through about 300 to 400 oysters here a week from the east and west coasts. This oyster is from Maryland's Chesapeake Bay, and its top and bottom shell are going back there. Lewis and her staff toss the spent shells in a 35-gallon barrel with a screw-on lid. It's located in the trash area on the ground floor of the building.
So nobody likes to recycle the oyster shells because there's flies everywhere and it's nasty. Gross. But we're doing something good. Let's get out of here.
About once a month, a truck picks up the old shells from this and six other participating restaurants in Pittsburgh and drives them more than 250 miles to a staging area just across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge in Maryland. From there, the oyster shells from Pittsburgh and ones collected from Maryland, Virginia, and the D.C. area are taken to a site at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Laboratory in Cambridge for processing.
So here you're looking at about 7,000 tons of clean shell.
Karis King is with Oyster Recovery Partnership, a nonprofit which works to increase oyster numbers in the Chesapeake Bay. We're standing at the base of a mountain of gray shells. They've been dumped into a machine that's like a modified potato hopper, which sorts the shells, and washed with water from the nearby Choptank River, a major tributary of the bay. Smaller fragments of broken shell fall away as a conveyor belt deposits the half shells into wire cages or piles, where they're cured for a year. Then they're ready to go on to the next phase of the recycling chain.
Even with, you know, all of the shell that we do recycle and that we also purchase some from shucking houses, we still don't have enough to do large-scale restoration at the rate that we could.
That's because of the scale of the problem. Stephanie Alexander manages the Horn Point Lab oyster hatchery.
When John Smith sailed up in the 1600s, he was running around on the oysters.
Alexander says that's before these waters were over-harvested, before there was agricultural runoff and soil erosion from development.
We've pretty much wiped the oyster out to less than 1% of historic levels. So we started this restoration effort where we're using a hatchery to produce spat on shell to put back into the bay so we can kind of help jumpstart Mother Nature.
The concept is pretty simple. Scientists here at the lab produce baby oysters from adults harvested from the bay, nurture the microscopic larvae with a custom algae diet, then get them to attach to the recycled treated oyster shells. That's the spat on shell. In practice, it's a lot harder than it sounds. Ben Malmgren is an intern here, a student from St. Mary's College of Maryland.
Right now, we're placing the oysters out on the spawning table where we are going to simulate river conditions that are ideal for spawning.
The saltiness and temperature of the water in the shallow black basins has to be just right. Malmgren places the oysters in a grid formation, so it's easier to separate the males from the females.
Because if we just let them spawn out on the table, all these eggs are going to go down to into the drain. So once we see a female, and we'll know she's a female by she'll clap her top and bottom shell together, and it'll see a plume of eggs come out. It'll kind of look like Splenda, like in a cup of coffee.
Then he'll pull the females off the table, where they'll continue to spawn in a tub. Those eggs will be fertilized with the sperm collected from the male oysters. But the oysters aren't cooperating today. Left to their own devices, it could take hours.
It's a lot like just watching a pile of rocks, but it can be exciting when they all start going.
Even in the lab, nature is in charge. Stephanie Alexander says it was a slow summer. A lot of rain meant the adult oysters have lived with lower salinity levels, and they're stressed. Out in the bay, the water is warmer, meaning the spat on shell might have a harder time growing that second shell, and over the years, forming the clusters that create oyster reefs.
When one thing gets out of whack, everything else is going to kind of follow. So we're trying to get the oysters back into balance, so then hopefully everything else will follow as well.
Over the last two decades, the lab and Oyster Recovery Partnership have planted over 8 billion oysters on the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries, with the help of other partners like the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Throughout the summer, spat on shell are released from a boat on sites where they're most likely to survive. And Alexander says that's critical.
Oysters are the vacuum cleaners or the kidneys of the bay, and they just suck the water in. They decide if it's food or not food, but no matter what it is, they'll remove it from the water column, and that's how they vacuum the bay up and clean it.
Because of this superpower, oyster aquaculture is a best management practice, identified by the regional partnership that oversees cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. Some of the spat raised at the Horn Point Lab will make its way to oyster farmers, and those are the oysters on a half shell that are served in restaurants. But the majority of the spat will help rebuild oyster reefs, creating habitat for fish and restoring the ecosystem. Back in Pittsburgh, Jessica Lewis is educating diners and trying to convince other Pittsburgh restaurants to join the oyster shell recycling effort that feeds the conservation work, to see the value in giving back.
With all this like climate change going on and all the scary things, it's like a bright light shining through and that we did something good.
Her pitch, every shell counts. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
Coal mining is the first chapter in the history of one Appalachian town. Now, Norton, Virginia is looking to write its second chapter in the nearby mountains.
When you have mountain bikers come to your town, they're going to come out of the woods and come down and frequent your restaurants.
Betting on recreation. Stay tuned. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. In addition to bringing up large quantities of oil and gas around the country, the fracking boom is vastly increasing the production of ethane, a key resource for the petrochemicals and plastics industry. Shell is building an ethane cracker near Pittsburgh, and a company from Thailand may build another one in Ohio to turn the region's ethane into plastic. But Pennsylvania is producing so much ethane that some of it's getting shipped overseas. So I headed to Scotland recently to find out how Pennsylvania shale gas is fueling the plastics industry in the UK. My first story in the series is coming up in a moment. Stay tuned. At the top of a hillside on his 200-acre cattle farm in southwestern Pennsylvania, George Watson peers over a well pad on his property and several others nearby.
When you look around here, though, there's wells on about every, not every ridge top, but there's a lot of wells around here. They're scattered everywhere.
Gas has brought problems for Watson. Fights over royalties, dead cattle he blames on toxic spills, land subsidence and soil erosion he blames on drilling operations. But with all these problems, there's been an upside, too.
Oh, money-wise? Yeah, I got more money than I ever had before, but, you know, I've always sort of been blessed with money. I've been working since I was 5 years old. You know, I've always had money, but not money like I got right now, but I'm making some money off these wells. I wouldn't lie to you about that.
The 9 wells on his property are producing over 1 billion cubic feet of gas a month, according to state records. Most of the gas coming out of these wells is methane, which is sent to fuel power plants, heat homes, and power industrial equipment. But there are also other gases coming out of these wells. These include a gas called ethane. Ethane is a raw ingredient in petrochemicals and plastics. And not far from here, Shell is building a chemical plant to convert some of the region's ethane into plastic. But there's so much of it coming out of the ground right now that chemical plants in the U.S. can't use it all. So companies are shipping some of this ethane to chemical plants in China, India, and Europe.
If we weren't exporting ethane right now, they'd be giving it away for free.
Steve McGinn is an editor for the chemical trade publisher ICIS. He says ethane is the base for a broad array of plastics and chemicals, everything from plastic bottles to clothing to medicine.
And all these plastics and all these fibers and everything basically comes from ethane.
And there's more ethane in the U.S. than ever. The fracking boom has doubled the amount of oil and gas the U.S. produces in the last decade, but it's also allowed companies to tap into rock deposits like shales, which are high in what are called natural gas liquids, a group that includes ethane. Warren Vilchevsky is an economist at the U.S. Energy Information Administration.
The gas that's produced from these shale formations is significantly richer in natural gas liquids than conventional gas would be.
In 2011, the Switzerland-based chemical company INEOS began looking for a new ethane supply for its chemical plants in Europe. Vilchevsky says those plants were relying on the declining North Sea oil fields.
So INEOS looked at the United States, where ethane supply was growing and where, especially in the Appalachian region, that ethane had like no place to go, and they recognized an opportunity.
INEOS officials did not agree to an interview for this story, but in a company video, CEO Jim Radcliffe says importing cheap American shale gas was necessary to save the company's European chemical plants.
I think for some of these assets in Europe, it's the only way they can survive if we can bring some of the US economics across to Europe to feed these big assets that we've got over here.
INEOS commissioned a fleet of ships to carry ethane across the Atlantic from a port near Philadelphia to its plants in the UK and Norway. But before it could do that, it had to get the gas from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. To bring the gas across Pennsylvania, Sunoco Logistics is building the Mariner East Pipeline Project through the southern part of the state. But the plan has been controversial. Construction resulted in dozens of spills and complaints of water contamination. Also, Pennsylvania allowed Sunoco to use eminent domain to build the pipeline across the properties of dozens of landowners. One of these property owners was Ellen Gerhart, who wanted to keep her property forested. In 2016, a chainsaw crew cut down a grove of trees on her property to make way for the pipeline. Eminent domain is usually used for projects that will benefit the public. But Gerhart thought a pipeline that sends Marcellus shale gas to overseas chemical plants did not fit that description.
It's not carrying anything that can be used for home fuels or vehicle fueling, anything like that. It's all going to Marcus Hook.
Marcus Hook is the port near Philadelphia where INEOS is putting ethane onto ships bound for Europe. In 2016, the first ships carrying ethane from Marcus Hook arrived in Scotland.
Inside, it is the first delivery for INEOS of shale gas into the UK. It's arriving at Grangemouth later this morning and just at the moment going under the two and a bit bridges, three almost bridges.
All of this starts on land like George Watson's in Pennsylvania and ends in places like the INEOS plant in Grangemouth, Scotland. In a 2016 video produced by the company, plant manager Kenneth Stevenson said he was excited about getting the new supply of shale gas.
Oh yes, definitely. People are looking forward to doing their job fully to the capacity of what the plant can produce.
Kevin Ross has seen the increased activity at the INEOS Grangemouth plant firsthand. He's president of the Scottish Plastics and Rubber Association and has a plastics company near the Grangemouth plant.
I can't underestimate the importance of the American shale gas and the feedstock costs for INEOS. It is driving investment decisions into Grangemouth, which wouldn't have been made if it wasn't for the availability of the shale gas.
Experts say ethane exports are only going to continue. There's just so much ethane in the U.S. in places like the Marcellus Shale, and other countries want it. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University. Celebrating nearly 30 years of preparing environmental professionals, the center provides multidisciplinary undergraduate and graduate education with opportunities for research and internships, including the Environmental Science and Management Master's Degree and Professional Certificate programs. Applications for the spring and summer semesters are now being accepted. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
As the coal industry continues to decline in the region, many coal-dependent communities are left asking, what's next? For some, a different kind of natural resource could be the key. For Ohio Valley Resource, reporter Brittany Patterson visited one community in southwestern Virginia that's betting big on outdoor recreation, with help from one unusual local attraction.
Just a few miles from the brick building-lined streets of downtown Norton lies a city-owned 1,000-acre outdoor recreation paradise.
So we are now entering the Flag Rock Recreation Area.
Fred Ramey is Norton's city manager. Inside the park, there are signs that read, Trail Crossing, Official Wood Booger Sanctuary.
All right, what's up with the wood booger?
You want the real story? Now, the wood booger came about actually unexpectedly.
A local legend about a Bigfoot-style creature got national exposure.
On this episode of Finding Bigfoot, the team from the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization heads to Southwest Virginia to investigate a Bigfoot sighting.
After this Animal Planet show aired in 2012, new visitors came to Norton searching for the legendary animal locals now call the wood booger.
It's been
good for business.
Steve Jesse works at Home Hardware and Furniture in downtown Norton, which sells t-shirts with the wood booger's likeness. The city created the Wood Booger Sanctuary, and it even spawned a festival in October that draws hundreds of people.
People just have a lot of fun with it.
Remy says the town has something a lot more solid than a mythical mountain creature. Norton is betting on the very real value of the mountains around them. For decades, coal was king here, but since 2008, Virginia's coal production has fallen by about half.
In a certain way, our community has found itself at another intersection, and due to the loss of coal, and that's when we had to really start thinking differently.
The city already has a service-based economy. Things like hotels, restaurants, good roads are already here. So tourism made a lot of sense.
It just made common sense to us that we ought to look at expanding our potential in tourism.
But becoming a tourist mecca doesn't happen overnight. The city has invested in 8 miles of mountain bike trails, with more going in every day.
When you have mountain bikers come to your town, they're going to come out of the woods and come down and frequent your restaurants.
Shane Fields is the trail coordinator for Norton and an avid cyclist.
You'll have patronage at your restaurants, your hotels, any little shops you have in town.
Mark Haggerty with the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics says several communities have had success making this transition from coal to outdoor recreation. But he warns outdoor recreation by itself is no silver bullet.
Recreation is really a means to an end. So what a recreation strategy does for you is it makes your community more attractive, and it has to be set within a broader economic development strategy.
Walking the trails in Flag Rock Recreation Area, Fred Ramey says he agrees.
We're not saying that tourism is going to be our answer, but we believe it can be part of the solution.
While numbers are hard to come by, Ramey says judging by license plates from Florida and North Carolina in the parking lot on this random weekday, it does seem to be working. And if one of them finds the wood booger, all the better.
We've got a friend that believes in Bigfoots and
all
stuff.
Right. We're going through with you.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson in Norton, Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Reed Frazier. Carol Holsoppel will be back next week.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Colcom Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. Our Trump on Earth podcast is supported by the Robert F. Schumann Foundation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.